Ladies and gentlemen, before we start, can I just make a few announcements, please? The first is that any of you who need a Wi-Fi password, just go to the desk in front and they will give you the necessary information. So please do that. And then there's a request that those of you who have given papers thus far and who have it available on a flash disk, please go and hand it over there at the information desk. They want to put it all on so that it can be available. So please, if you'll do that. Then there were questions whether the water here is drinkable. Yes, it's completely drinkable. You can use the tap water, so you needn't be afraid of that. And then Cole Durham asked that all the members of the steering committee, and coffee has arrived, so he's also included, this evening after the speech of Judge Sachs, we must just have a meeting in one of the rooms adjacent here. So we'll meet there just for a short meeting. Okay, I think that's what I want to say. Ian, over to you.
Thanks very much. This is the second plenary session, and it's my pleasure to call on two scholars who will speak for approximately 30 minutes or less each, leaving us some minutes for questions. First up is Francois Muller, and the general theme is theology and law in African traditional religion. So, Francois Muller, thank you. And by now, you should all have the biographies of that are available on the table outside, making any comment from me unnecessary.
Before I start, I would just like to know, I put the same page on the screen. If there are people who cannot see the screen, of course it's a little bit unclear. We're welcome to meet some of them. Unfortunately, I do not have enough for everyone, but we can distribute a few of them in any case. And then I also have to warn you that I'm somewhat of a people pleaser, meaning that I will make some deliberate mistakes even to satisfy those who are looking for mistakes. Just used to wait for people to come in, but it seems we should start. My introduction, I started by citing a few examples just to convince the audience that religion is such an integral part of human life that no government can afford to ignore it, and that there are so many conflicts in which religion plays a definitive role that governments are inadvertently drawn into it. It seems to me that I don't even need to cite the examples to convince you about that. Therefore, I want to propose that the question of when addressing the quest for common good in pluralistic societies, the question on how civil governments and persons in authority should relate to religion is a key question when you want to have a peaceful pluralistic society. In this paper, I argue that the approach taken by Article 36 of the Welsh Confession, especially in the way that it has been revised in South Africa, provide a key for answering this question. And I want to argue this by addressing the three following points, and those are more or less the points that are on the screen as well. Firstly, something about the background and the status of the Welsh Confession. Secondly, something about Article 36 itself, its content, and the way it has been revised in South Africa. And lastly, common good principles and the sound application of Article 36. Now, a creed or a confession is, from the start of the New Testament, Christians used that to state key matters of doctrine, key statements of faith. Since the time of the New Testament, the Apostles' Creed, the Apostolic Creed, also known as, and the Nicene Creed has been virtually accepted in most Christian communities. During the time of the Reformation, which was also an era characterized by bloody religious conflict, persecution and war, a number of confessions were formulated to express faith from a Protestant point of view. Apart from the Lutheran tradition, the confessions that are still widely accepted today are mostly the Heidelberg Catechism, the Canons of Dort, and then usually one of at least the Westminster Confession, the Second Helvetic Confession, or then the Belgian Confession that we're looking at today. Most of these confessions have undergone some form of revision, and except for the Canons of Dort, all of them have a rather general scope, meaning that something is confessed about government and people in authority in them as well. But this is also because of the era in which they were formulated. Now, concerning the Belgian Confession itself, it was drawn up in 1561 by Guido de Bray, a reformed minister, during the Dutch revolt against the Roman Catholic authorities. Roman Catholic Spain, I should rather say. This was also a time when the Corpus Christianum was violently breaking apart, and when the religious dissidents were commonly considered traitors, when heresy was treated as a criminal offense, and blasphemy was punishable by death. It was firmly believed by Roman Catholics and by Protestants, most Protestants, that a unified religion was essential for a unified, peaceful society, and that the state had a necessary role to play in maintaining this. Now, the Bray drew up the confession to indicate the link between the Reformed faith and that of the first Christians of the first few centuries. But more importantly, he wanted to distinguish that what the Reformed Christians believed from what the Anabaptists believed. The Anabaptists were also opposing the Roman Catholic Church, and some of them refused to swore allegiance to any worldly authority or civil authority, refused to pay taxes, refused to render military service, founded holy, independent, faith-based communities, actions which no government of the time wanted to allow. The Anabaptists were, however, the first people to promote a complete separation between church and state. With the Belgian Confession, the Bray tried to indicate that the Reformed Christians did not deserve to be persecuted as if they were Anabaptists. Eventually, in 1565, the Bray was hanged by the Inquisition, and he was thus ironically executed by the very same authorities whom he confessed in Article 36 to have been given by God. Concerning the acceptance of the status of the Belgian Confession, De Bray's attempt to convince King Philip of Spain II failed. Yet his confession soon received wide acceptance, and the first synods of the Reformed churches started to require of all ministers to formally accept the Belgian confession. The internationally dedicated synod of Dort, 1618-1690, also accepted the Belgian confession as one of the three forms of unity for the Reformed churches. And today it is accepted by several Reformed churches, even some Presbyterian churches all over the world. I've counted several churches in Africa that accept that. South Africa, Mozambique, Zambia, DRC, Sudan, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, which consists or represents about 2.5 million people. Now the fact that the Belgian Confession was drawn up in a time when unity in society was becoming pluralist, when the relation between church and state or between religion and secular authority was at the center, demands that we should take note of this document, especially as it is not only recognized internationally, but in Africa too. If we turn to Article 36 itself, the Belgian Confession contains 37 articles, making Article 36 the preliminary article. The Belgian Confession starts out by professing belief in the existence of God. Article 36 focuses on God's benevolence and his gifts to and demands from firstly those who are in and secondly those who are under civil authority. Let me just repeat that. Article 36 focuses on God's benevolence and his gifts and demands from firstly those who are in and secondly those who are under civil authority. The article concludes by denouncing all who promote anarchy. But it is worth mentioning that Article 36 also states that everyone, doesn't matter what your social status is under the law. This is especially the first part of the article that we should look at today, especially where it is concerning the responsibilities of those in civil government. These statements do not only concern government's general responsibilities in keeping order within society, but also indicates a linked responsibility concerning religion, and specifically the Reformed version of Christianity. And in this sense, Article 36 actually takes a very extreme position concerning religion. As I've mentioned, Article 36 has also been revised differently by different churches all over the world. If one ever reckons with the church as primarily a local community in peculiar circumstances, which may differ from country to country, as well as with the nature of the confession, as a statement which is in principle always open to revision, it is to be expected that some churches will change certain articles in their own peculiar way. Some churches may not even change articles at all. Even subtle differences in dogma or prayer overall. Now, Article 36 is built on premises, fundamental premises, that may seem very extreme. For instance, Article 36 starts out with the stated belief that God, because of the depravity of all mankind, ordained civil authorities. This statement is built upon the belief stated in Article 1 that God certainly exists, that he is holy, unique, and spiritual, that he is the only true, one and true only God, and being triune, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, he is the creator, sustainer, and supreme ruler of heaven and earth. It is only through his Son Jesus Christ that he saves this fallen world from eternal damnation. The Belgian Confession not only states which role the Church of Jesus Christ plays in God's action within the world, but it also operates with a yet and not yet mindset. Although Christ has in principle already reconciled the fallen creation with God, everything has not been brought to fulfillment yet. While Christ has re-established the kingdom and reign of God, and while he uses his church and civil authorities in accomplishing this, he has not brought his reign to fulfillment yet. And therefore, we as humans constantly live within the tension of the yet and the not yet. Article 37 concludes the Doubting Confession by stating belief in God's final and eternal judgment. Now, it is from this, in a sense, rather extreme premises that Article 36 starts out by proclaiming that it is because of God's benevolence and in light of the fact that the world continually suffers from consequences of evil and sin, that God ordained that there should be civil authorities. He wants these authorities to govern according to laws and policies in order to restrain people's rudeness so that everything may be conducted in good order amongst humans. Article 36 also states that God has given government the sword to punish wrongdoers and to protect the virtuous. While most will agree that the civil authorities have these responsibilities towards keeping good order in society, only some will agree that this also includes a linked responsibility to public religion, something that Article 36 explicitly states. And this paper focuses on this linked responsibility of the civil authorities towards public religion, especially as it has been revised in South Africa. Now, before the revision was done in the late 1970s, Article 36 stated more or less, and I say more or less because I had to make my own English translation. I can explain later why I had to do that. Stated more or less that while it is not only the office of the civil government to attend to civil government, they also have the responsibility to keep their hand at the holy service of the church, to repel and eradicate all idolatry and false religion, destroy the dominion of Antichrist, to promote the kingdom of Jesus Christ, and to let the word of the gospel be preached everywhere, so that God will be honored and served as he commands in his word. The South African version of the Doubting Confession was translated from the Dutch and from the Latin texts of the Doubting Confession. Unfortunately, the translation created room for misunderstanding. And these words were taken to mean that the civil authorities had the task to, for instance, repel and eradicate idolatry and false religion. The fact that there were debates whether this task were to be performed directly or indirectly, the fact that there were debates whether the authorities should use the sword to perform these tasks or not doesn't mean that, or did not change the fact that these things were seen as part of the task of government. And it is understandable that the church, that has a close link to government, could very easily interpret this article in this way. At this point of view, if you take these things as part of the task of the civil government, fits very nicely into a theocratic system with a religious state. Now, although I think everyone will agree that a Muslim state will not promote the kingdom of Jesus Christ, I can think of myself that they will promote the Islam faith, the reverence of the Prophet Muhammad, also in the very strong same terms. The previous version of Article 36 can also be made to fit into a system with a state church where one specific religion is recognized as the official religion while other religions are tolerated. And Great Britain, with the Anglican Church as the official state church, is a prime example of this. Looking for examples in Africa, it must be mentioned that neither the Union of South Africa or the Republic of South Africa has ever recognized a specific church or a specific institution officially. The preamble of the Constitution of Zambia currently states, "We the people of Zambia, in exercise of our constitutional powers, of constituent power, acknowledge the supremacy of God Almighty and declare the Republic a Christian nation while upholding the right of every person to enjoy that person's freedom of conscience and religion." I couldn't have ever find any reference in the Zambian Constitution that specifically allows any benefits to Christianity itself. And I would like, if anyone know about any African country who has a similar church-state system, if you could tell me about that. Both the religious state system and the state religion system, in both these, civil authority can recognize anybody to inform it on which institutions, which practices should be regarded as false religion and as idolatry, so that the state can act against that. However, neither the theocratic or the state religion systems is suitable for a pluralistic society and brings much oppression and conflict along with it. I will return to the South African revision of Article 36. In 1905, the Dutch revision, or the Dutch version of Article 36 was revised, and there were a lot of calls for the same revision to be done in South Africa. And over the years, these calls were rejected for several reasons. And it was only when, in the late 1970s, that the mainline Reformed churches decided to retranslate the Belgian Confession into more modern Afrikaans, that it was realized that the original, or the version that was accepted until that time, the translation was not done from the original French as well, but only from the Dutch and the Latin. And if you look at the original French text, which the Synod of Dort accepted, it was clear that those things that were taken as part of the task of civil government were actually meant to be part of the goals with which government should perform its task. It's even clear in English, you can even make the same mistake if I say you have the responsibility to do that in order to do, you have the responsibility to do this and to do that. It seems as if you are taking two responsibilities, where actually the part in Article 36 which refers to the movement of false religion was actually only stated as the goal with which civil government should perform its duties towards public religion. Civil government's responsibility towards public religion therefore mainly consists in governing in such a way that the church also is allowed to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ and to live accordingly. A civil government could do this by protecting civil rights such as the freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, freedom of speech and association, movement, by protecting one's rights to change one's religion, and the right to self-identification. And because it is not up to the government to decide which religion is true and which not, or which version of which religion is valid, government does not need to afford these rights only to Reformed Christians, but these rights may be extended to all. And government should treat these matters impartially incidentally, the current South African Constitution, and specifically Article 15 of the Constitution on religious freedom, is also in line with this stance. Article 15 allows for all religions to be practiced publicly under certain clear conditions and well-motivated restrictions. It is therefore an unfortunate misconception that South Africa is a neutral state which has a division between religion and government similar to that of the USA. My second last topic. It can also be asked why it is not preferable for governments to take a neutral stance. Why is it better for government to take an impartial stance rather than a neutral stance? In the first instance, anyone who accepts that Jesus Christ is Lord of all of creation will also regard him as the Lord of the public sphere. That, however, does not mean to say that any church or any religious institution is also in control of the public sphere. Yet it is not even only Reformed Christians that accept that Christ is Lord of all creation. But even if you differ with this statement, there are at least two more compelling reasons why government should not relinquish its involvement in the public religious sphere to a neutral stance. Whenever the public sphere is regarded as neutral, it promotes secularism as a veiled or distinct or disguised religion which forces out other religions out of the public sphere and brings new forms of oppression and conflict. Jean-Jacques Rousseau famously quipped, if they do not want to be free, we will force them to be free. Neutrality is thus only a so-called neutrality and eventually forces everyone who does not want to be free from religion out of the public sphere. The current problem in France with the wearing of religious symbols to public schools is a clear example of this. And if someone can give me some examples from Africa, I will be glad for that as well. Neutrality eventually requires an extreme application which impartiality does not. Now, while there are objections to the current South African version of Article 36, and the objections is that it distorts the historic meaning of the article, I believe that this version provides us with the key today on how governments should relate to religion, especially within societies that are becoming more pluralistic. Now we can lastly turn to the question of why does he... Now we can lastly turn to the question of why does he to the question of how those in authority should relate to religion should be accepted generally. It is my position that the South African version of Article 36 is, firstly, an expression of biblical theology. Secondly, in harmony with certain vital human rights in general, including religious rights in particular. It provides for anyone to take an extreme religious position, yet in such a moderate way that it does not infringe on the rights of others. It will, on the contrary, rather promote the common good by keeping government's linked responsibility toward public religion intact in an impartial way. Although many may not consider this issue to be of vital importance, for most Christians it is important that whatever we confess or believe will be in line with Scripture. When coming to the Belgian Confession, it is especially important for the integrity of the document because it states in Article 5 that all true religion is measured against the Bible. While Romans 13 states that there is no authority except which God has established, and why Christ, while Christ rightfully claims authority over all creation in Matthew 28, there is no passage in the New Testament where God commands the use of force in order that anyone should worship or serve him. Although some of the anointed kings of the Old Testament of Israel were indeed ordered by God to destroy the idols violently and to kill those who worshipped them, the offices of these kings were fulfilled in Christ and could therefore not be taken today as examples of how government should act today. By refraining from a call to the use of force or any other means of coercion in order to promote Christianity, Article 36, while honoring the triune God as the one and only God, promotes the right to religious freedom and conscience. It should therefore also be kept in mind that whenever someone is forced to accept a religion by the state, by positive or negative means, it would rather promote the false religion than prevent it. Christianity is in the first place a religion of the inner person, of someone's heart and mind. And while a state or a government or anyone can control someone's actions, no one can really control what happens within a person. In the current version of Article 36 of the Belgian Confession, as well as Article 15 of the Constitution, respects this reality properly. The current version of Article 36 of the Belgian Confession thus reckons with both the right to freedom of religion and conscience, the values of integrity and authenticity. It also, in line with Jesus' teaching, reckons with the principle of accountability concerning those in and those under authority. It is not required by civil law anyone. It is not required by civil law of anyone who does not know the Lord to love or to serve him. Lastly, by allowing someone to even take an extreme religious position, yet apply it in such a moderate way in public that it honors and in fact strengthens rights such as the freedom of conscience, religion, and speech, and by promoting social values such as accountability, authenticity, and integrity, the sound application of the South African version of Article 36, the standard of the Church, will enhance the quest for common good, especially in pluralistic societies where religious differences may lead to conflict. This version manages to keep government's responsibility towards religion intact by limiting the task of government to creating the circumstances in which different religions can all function together in public. In this way, the article provides for a government to play a positive, impartial role rather than a so-called neutral role, which is actually negative and to the disadvantage of the common good. I thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Mueller. There'll be some questions, I imagine. Yes? You want to speak into this mic, it might help.
Let me just say that I have always found this impartial position not working. You know, as a kid, I grew up, I wasn't religious, I didn't come from a religious house, but you had to mention your church's name on all papers, so the only church I knew was Apostolic Faith Mission. And from my third grade, I was discriminated against because of that. Despite a position of neutrality, I mean, it was very clear, at least in the Afrikaans schools, if you're not one of the, belong to one of the sisters' churches, you were an object for either conversion or discrimination. In Namibia, that same pattern went on for the first year I was there after independence, and then I challenged the school on the grounds of the neutrality of the state, which helped. They immediately stopped what they called then, I can't think of how to translate it now, but jeugdweerbaarheid, youth, what's the good word?
Youth preparedness,
yes, and I challenged them on the grounds of the Constitution and threatened them to take them to court, and it stopped. So I think, you know, what we have in Namibia as a constitution, as a secular state, for the sectarians like myself at least, it's a much better position than some kind of impartial role that never works. It's always the majority church that wins the day.
Thank you, Jay. I want to ask Professor Muller, I want to ask him, do you know anything about the direct origin of Article 36 in the Belgium Confession of Faith? I ask this because I personally think that what the reformers did in the 15th and 16th century is that they didn't create a new view on church-state relations or religion-state relations, but they went back to the position as it was under Constantine, when Christianity was officially recognized by the Roman Empire, and that meant that they protected the church, the authorities protected the church, but they also governed the church. And it is very interesting to look what happens in the time of the Reformation. In England, you get the Anglican state church, the established church, with a king as its head. In Germany, you get that the head of the province or the governor of the province becomes his religion will be that which is followed in that state. And in the Netherlands, it is also a case of the authorities governing the church, not only protecting the church, but governing the church. And therefore, I think that the system that came to South Africa was not a theocratic system. It was a Constantinian system, where the authorities governed the church and they directed the church, while at the same time professing that they protect the church. And I would just like to know, do you know perhaps a little bit more about the origins, the direct origins of Article 36? Who's next?
Dr. Muller, sorry, I'll give you a moment there. Rich Willis, Christian Lawyers Association. I just want to make sure, I appreciate and I'm encouraged by the approach from a legal perspective of considering the Belgian Confession, but I don't understand you in any way to infer any deficiencies in the Charter for Religious Rights that most of us now subscribe to. Am I correct in that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Quickly respond, just to say, I think it's exactly because of this point of view from Article 36 that I accept the Charter. I think they are in harmony. Concerning the question of impartiality, perhaps impartiality is the lesser evil, because neutrality is definitely worse. Neutrality eventually enhances secularism, as if it is not even a religion, and forces out all religiously orientated points of view from discussion, as if it is not valid at all. I agree with you that impartiality is not the perfect answer, but I think it is exactly because we live in the tension of the yet and the not yet, that we have to take the least bad answer, to put it in that way. I also think that the circumstances in South Africa has changed since 1994. Previously, Article 36, although the wording had been changed, had been very much interpreted in a way for a state religion, which the wording does not allow for, if you read it closely as it is, has been reworded. So although I have sympathy with what you said, I do not agree with you. And interestingly, I think Namibia and I think India are examples of an active, neutral point of view regarding the relationship between church and religion, or not church and religion, state and religion.
We have to call it there in deference to the next speaker. So thanks very much. Okay.